Good evening. My name is Claire, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober. And I'd like to thank you, Kay. And I'd like to thank Merton and the committee for this privilege, because it's always a privilege to be asked to participate in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm especially grateful to be here tonight. I always have that feeling as I look out over a room like this at your smiling faces, and I get that feeling that I'm standing in the sunlight of the Spirit. And I watch your beautiful smiles, and I often sit on planes as I come into cities that I've never been to, the wonderful state of Florida before. And I sit on the plane, and I look out the window, and I am grateful to God. Because I'm usually sitting in a place, and in a place in my life, when I have to ask my question, how did I ever get from that place to this place? And that's what I am feeling as I stand here tonight. When I was in the ghetto, that's where I drank my way to the ghetto in Los Angeles, California, where I'd reached a place in my life where I was sick of living and I was scared to die. And I ended up in that ghetto with two young children. And I knew my life was over, but I couldn't stop drinking, and I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I can remember sometimes how I would come to in that ghetto, sometimes out in the front yard, out of blackouts, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'd have that same thought, how did I ever get there? And I can remember how I would just stand up around that hour in the morning, that terrible hour in the morning where I would feel that I was the only human being on the planet, and I had somehow been deserted and left there, and I would feel that inside feeling of loneliness and despair. I would brush myself off, and it was always important for me to look good. And I can remember I would look across the street to see who was looking in the neighborhood after I brushed myself off, and I could always depend on the woman who lived across the street. I think she kind of monitored the neighborhood. And when I got to that ghetto area of Los Angeles, I certainly didn't go into that neighborhood to become sociably accepted. I believe I was down in that neighborhood with the drapes drawn, and I was doomed to die of this disease. And I would see her curtains moving back and forth, brush myself off, give her the finger. Straighten up. Get up the steps, you know, close the door, lean on the door, take a deep breath. I was so sick. Get through that living room, get down the hall, get to the bathroom, get on my knees in front of the toilet bowl, do a few chin-ups on the rim of the toilet bowl, and throw up my insides, and it seems as if I was throwing up my soul. And at that moment, I would always try to make deals with God. I didn't believe in God, but it was that moment when I was, that alcoholic prayer, when I would say, God, please, if you get me out of this one. And I would stand up, and like Dr. Silkworth says, you know, about the phenomenon of craving. And by that time, I drank because I had to drink just to breathe in and out. And I would stand up and put on my tight jeans and put on my bad leather jacket and my red wig. And by that time, I was a winette. And in chapter 3 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the basic text of our program, it describes in that chapter what we do, the insanity of the disease, to keep from doing step 1 and 2. And it says we switch to natural wines. Well, I hadn't switched to a natural wine, but I had switched to Ripple. Now, that's not one of your natural wines. As a matter of fact, I don't think grapes have ever been near it. I think it's just that they put the chemicals in a bottle, shake it up, put it on the shelf, and I managed at 6 o'clock in the morning by that time to be standing in some liquor store in front of a clerk, you know, getting my share. And I put on that wig and start to get dressed and make the run. I had a pair of Starfire earrings that hung to my shoulders, and I had long since given up puke. I had been reduced to gold fuzzy house slippers. And I would slide on those slippers, And I can remember going down that little hall and going through past that room where the door was open, and I can still hear those two children sleeping quietly. And I can remember the shame that I felt. And I can remember the guilt that I felt when I had to pass that room and tiptoe, turn up my collar, because I didn't want to wake them up so they'd see Mama having to make her run again. And every morning when I'd go through that ritual, I'd make the same promise that I'm not going to do this anymore. But I'd tiptoe down the stairs and get past three houses to get down to the liquor store and stand in front of the door and through my dark glasses watch the Los Angeles Times truck drop off the papers. And the Wonder Bread man drop off the bread in front of the door, and I'd be standing there cool, waiting for the man to come. And looking out of my dark glasses and viewing the world like I always viewed the world, that it was a hostile place and I didn't know how to live in it. And I never for one moment thought that alcohol had anything to do with the fact that I was powerless over alcohol in the second half of that first step and my life was unmanageable. I didn't think that had anything to do with it. I knew it was people, places, and things. Now they'd just get off my back and stop telling me about my potential and stop asking me those questions that I couldn't answer. And finally the man would come, open that door, and I'd follow him inside. And you talk about denial. I would follow him into that liquor store and go over into the grocery department and browse around among the cans. Now I was hanging out over with the Campbell soup, you know, because I didn't want this guy to know that I was in there for me, and I was shaking and I was smelling like an animal because I was living like one. And finally, when out of the corner of my eyes, I'd see him put the change away. And I ease up to the counter, and you'd start to play games. Now, I knew all about playing the games of life. I'd been out in the streets for 27 years on a daily basis playing the game of life. And I turn my head sideways, and he turned his head sideways, because normal people don't get out of bed at 6 o'clock in the morning to come to the liquor store to browse in the grocery department. And finally, he'd say to me, the games that they play at that hour in the morning, he'd say to me, what are you going to have? Well, hey, man, I'm not in here for milk, you know. And I would put that 59 cent up on that counter, and I would feel the shame, because most of the time I would have stolen that money from my kids, or I had to come to with some sleaze stranger, and that was the price I had to pay for it. To get the 59 cents for the wine. I guess I felt like Bill W. when he talks in the chapter to Bill W. when he talks about taking the money from his wife's purse to buy the bathtub of gin, and I would stand there and say, I'm not going to do this anymore. And then I would say, I'm going to pay them back. And I would remember how my family had bought my oldest son bonds for his education, and I would go and cash him in because I need the wine more than I thought he was going to need that education. But I always made the promise I'll pay him back, and I always wanted to do that. But the phenomenon of craving was already there, and I had to have a drink first. And he would shove it in the bag and wrap the paper bag around the top of the bottle, and he'd hand it to me, and I was still trying to be cute. And I'd say to this guy things like, have a nice day, honey. Well, I didn't care what kind of day he had, really, you know. I just wanted to get out of his sight, get past the plate glass window. I had long since given up crystal glasses, and I had long since worried about the ritual of bottle openers. All I had to do was unscrew the top, lean on the villain, take a hit off that wine, and feel that feeling. Dr. Silkworth says men and women drink essentially like because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And it would start the fantasies. And I could straighten up and walk back quietly, you know, where I had shuffled down there in the first place. Climb up those steps and sit in the chair and watch the dawn come up and hear those two children. My daughter was about 8 years old and my son was about 9 and a half years old at the time. And I'd sit there in my terra cloth robe with wine stains on it and my red wig on and my bottle sitting on the table. And I could hear them in the kitchen making their breakfast and quietly talking to each other and getting their lunch together to go to school. And I sat there hating myself because I could not participate in their lives. And I would always say, tomorrow, I'm going to do that tomorrow. And I always wanted to believe that. And then I would see the dawn, and I'd see people coming out of that ghetto and running down the stairs and going to work or wherever people were going that were seemed to have been functioning out there in the world, and I couldn't do that. Instead, I stared out at the world and watched the world go by, feeling apparently like the man who said, I had a dream last night, that life was passing me by and I wasn't in it. And all my dreams were gone and all my goals were gone, and I had nothing else to do but sit in the chair and die physically, emotionally, and spiritually, and reminisce about tomorrow and the regrets of yesterday, and watch their heads go past the window, and I'd sit there and I'd drink some more, and I'd pass out, and I'd come to, and it was around 10 o'clock in the morning, and I was living off food stamps and welfare, and I would sit in that chair and say, how did I get from that place to this place, and start to wonder what went wrong when I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, in a nice family as I understand it today. I'm the youngest of 7 children. My father was a full-blooded Cherokee Indian who was born on a reservation in North Carolina, who migrated to Atlanta at around 21 years old and had this family. My father was considered in those days to be successful. He was an artist. And we had all of the outside pleasures of life, all of the rules that were supposed to, that we could grow up and be somebody and to be counted. And I always felt discounted. You know, I believe I am one of those that was born restless, irritable, and discontented. And my parents were not alcoholics. And my brothers and sisters were not and are not alcoholics. I'm the alcoholic in the family, and I'm the youngest one in the family. My feelings about myself started at a very early age, low self-worth, low self-esteem, and I really felt inadequate as a human being. And that started as a little girl, and I had a lot of trouble in school, and I didn't think I was bright. I thought I was dumb, because that's what they call me. I isolated because I didn't know how to interact. I had a lot of problems with the church, and I grew up in the Baptist faith. I have nothing against the church today. I read the chapter to the agnostic, and I take full responsibility today for my behavior and my thoughts about the church and about God. I isolated, hung around Atlanta a lot, and I was very angry and full of rage. And I was always in the place they didn't want me to be, and I was always getting thrown out because I didn't like the system. And I wanted to change that. And I have learned, in the serenity prayer, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change and change the things I can, and that's my code for living today. But at that time, I was always in trouble in school. I isolated, and I painted, and I drew. And in my senior year, I went to my art teacher because I knew scholastically I would never get into an accredited school. And my teacher said to me, why don't you apply for a scholarship to an art school in Boston? And I did, and I got that scholarship, and I went to Boston. I remember sitting on the train, and my family came to see me off. And I was sitting on that train, and I looked out the window, and I had that feeling that I now know I was making a sober geographic, because I knew that once I got out of Atlanta and got to Boston, it was going to be different. And I wasn't going to be afraid anymore, and I was going to be able to go out in the world and interact with people, because I was so terrified of them. I thought if I got away from that family, if I just did this and if I did that. And when I got to Boston, it never occurred to me. I took me with me. And I just had the same feelings of being an inadequate person standing on a corner in another city. Went into that school, and I became an isolator, and my first addiction, I guess, was hanging out in the movies. trying to watch other people live to see how they did that. And I grew up in that wonderful family, but we were not a family that were emotionally attached to each other. We just had things. And there was never any interaction with each other. And so I'd sit in the movies and see how other people did it. I loved jazz music, and it was at a time when my real fantasy was to be an entertainer. And I could just see myself up there on that screen, and I have no talent in that area at all, but I could just sit there, you know, spend hours seeing myself up there on that screen, and I had never seen alcohol. And one night I was walking down the street in Boston, and a door opened, and I heard this great jazz music come out of that door, and I said to a friend that I had this person that was walking next to me, and I said, gosh, I wonder what they do in there. And I grew up in Georgia when it was a time when there was, it was a dry state. Until now I don't recall ever seeing a person drunk. I spent a lot of my teenage years in blackouts, emotional blackouts, and I don't remember a lot of it. And this person said, well, that's a jazz club. And I remember we walked in there. I said, well, let's go in there. We walk into this club, and we sat on a stool, and the bartender leaned over with a penitent smile. And he said to us, what are you going to have to drink? And neither one of us knew. And I remember in the movies, they always talked about martinis. And I leaned over, and I was about to commit my first hip-slip cool act. I said to this guy, I said, we'll have a martini, honey. I said, and make it dry. I had no idea what I was ordering. And this guy put these two lovely stem glasses up on this bar, and he evened it out, and it looked like lemonade. And I know in Georgia, we drank a lot of lemonade. And I didn't know you sip drinks. So I picked up this drink, I opened my mouth, and I just drowned it all at one time. I was a pig from the gate. But I loved the way it made me feel. It went down there, and I stopped trembling for the first time since I'd been 5 years old. And I looked around that room, and I just felt that excitement. And I looked up and down, and I thought to myself, these are going to be my new friends. And I don't need that school, and I started to make decisions. With that first martini, I'd never been able to make a decision in my whole life about anything. And that martini said, you're on your way, girl. I stepped off that bar. I called my new friends, the pimps, the hookers, and the madams, colorful. But the big book says they're lower companions. And I was out there so long, I became one of those lower companions. And I stepped out in that street of Boston and New York and Harlem, and I learned to walk the walk and talk the talk. And I was a fast learner out there in the streets. I didn't do too well in the school, but I had found my place, and I knew it was, and I have come to believe that God has put me in a path, and I've come to crossroads. And that first martini was the beginning of a lot of crossroads in my life, and it seems to me I invariably always chose the road that was self-destructive because there was something about the inside of me that I didn't like, and I knew I didn't belong here anyway. So I went out there and I started to do what later became the dance of death. With a glass in my hand, I met a young man, and I tried to lead that double life of I love those clubs, and I love the excitement. I love that feeling of living on the edge. And then there was that other side of me trying to live up to the expectations and the high achievements from the family they thought I should have. And I couldn't do that, and I just didn't fit in either place. But with a glass in my hand, I always fit wherever I was. And I was apparently willing to pay the price for that dance because it brought me to California later and in that ghetto. I met a nice young man, and we became drinking buddies. And we stayed in that marriage for 24 years, and it was the sickest relationship that I could imagine that two human beings could ever live together in. I mean, it was just two people who were never willing to take responsibility for ourselves and later our three children because we were too busy out there in the street, you know, playing the games of life. We had a little son, And that's when a lot of the guilt started, and because I was not adequate to take care of him. And I can be honest with you because I can tell you the truth. Because I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous from the very beginning, when I sat in that first meeting, April the 9th, 1974, almost 17 years ago, and you started to tell me that the truth would set me free. And the truth would set me free through the 12 steps that I call the spiritual principles of this program. And I can tell you that the truth didn't always make me feel good about myself, but it did set me free. And so I started to stay away from that little son. I pushed him off from his grandparents who raised him. And I would make my run over there every once in a while and pat him on the head as he grew up. And the thing that would always drive me out of that door was that look in his eyes. As that little boy growing up, and the look at that time when he was a little boy was a look of disappointment. Because I could never keep my promises to him that I would take him to the park. That son is 39 years old and I had never taken him to the park. And I want to tell you how grateful I am to a loving God that I've come to believe in. I've been given a second chance. Because that son has a 4-year-old son, that's the grandson that I take to the park today. And so I couldn't interact in his life. And I pat him on the head and send him to a better camp next year because I was an entourage junkie. See, my lifestyle was I know the difference between a lifestyle and a life today. Because my lifestyle was hanging out with the entourage and hanging in the jazz clubs. And there was always that part of me while that young husband of mine traveled and when I would run over there and see that kid because I couldn't stay too long. I couldn't get too far away from the dark rooms and the aroma of the cigarettes and the aroma of the booze and sitting on the stool with the other geniuses while we solved the problems of the world. And by the end of the evening, when I'd hours and hours and hours, and when the bar closed, you know, we'd always have one for the road and walk out into the darkness. And by that time, we were all legends in our own heads. And I'd get back to the bar. My ex-husband traveled a lot. And it was something about my personality that I have learned that I have an addictive personality and one is not enough. And while he traveled, I looked for Mr. Wonderful. I mean, the real Mr. Wonderful. And one night I was sitting on a bar stool with the late great legend Billie Holiday and we were drinking together. And because by that time I was starstruck and I was following all of the stars around, and that was my life for so long, and I wanted what they had because I figured their greatness would rub off on me by osmosis. And what I have learned, even in Alcoholics Anonymous, it does not rub off on you by osmosis. We have to earn it. And we were drinking, and Mr. Wonderful showed up at the end of the bar. If you had hanging jazz clubs long enough, they show up. He stood there with a black hat turned down all the way around. He had a blue top coat over his shoulders. And this dude was so cool that he couldn't get his arms through the sleeves. Mr. Wonderful reached in his pocket. He pulled out a wad of money that big. My eyes got that big. I loved money. And he peeled off 10 $100 bills. He flapped it down on the bar. He spread it like a deck of cards. And he said to me, "Spend it." Then I knew that God had answered my prayer. And Mr. Wonderful turned out to be the head of the mafia of the New England family. And I was then well into step two. And I can remember he would send the limousine for me. And those two bodyguards, Dick and Jerry. And Dick would float up to the door and ring the bell, and I'd sneak out of that house and climb into the back seat of the limousine, and we were off for the evening to pick up the entourage. And it seems to me there were moments in my madness that the alcohol began to turn. And you know, we talk about the progression of the disease. And I was beginning to change, and it was beginning to affect my outer appearance and my behavior. But I could not attribute that to the alcohol, because it would mean I would have to stop drinking, and how would I live sober? I just had no concept of ever living sober without drinking. Because alcohol by that time had become my higher power. It had become my lover, my confidant, my best friend. And so we'd step out into the streets, and we were off and running, and we'd run over to New York just to have a drink. And one morning, on a Sunday morning, that son was about 10 years old. And I was, at that point, going less and less over there because I couldn't stand his eyes. And he was getting older, and it wasn't as easy at that point to explain things to him, because I could see in his eyes the guilt that I felt, because I just couldn't do it. And, you know, and I have learned that in the big book where it says selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our problems. And that we alcoholics are driven by 100 forms of fear. Self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And you see, I had to get out of his sight and get back to my people. And one Sunday morning when I was being driven home in that limousine, I looked out the rear window and I saw young families with their little kids. And I had made a commitment when I sat on that train going from Atlanta to Boston that the one thing I would never do in my whole life is put my foot in a church again. Because God didn't love me, and I didn't know how to have any, I had no sense of spirituality. I had no sense. The only sense I had of God was fearful. And when I looked out of that window, something whispered to me. It was like a moment of truth. And something said to me, something's wrong with your life. And I thought, it's Boston. Now, what I need to do is get out of Boston. And I need to go someplace that I can become a better mother, where I can become a better wife, where I can participate in the community and live up to the expectations. And I got that ex-husband together, and when he picked up that little son, put him in the back seat of that car, we drove to California, and we ended up in Los Angeles. And I went with good intentions, and my intentions were always good until I picked up the first drink. And then all of those intentions went out of the window. And I crawled up on the first bar stool and the first bar I found in the neighborhood that we'd moved into. We had the two other children, and we by a fluke went into a small business, a maintenance business that got successful, and then I had another dilemma to deal with. I never knew what to do with success. It just simply meant that I was going to have to buy more love. And I always bought my love from people. And I was such a people pleaser, I want to tell you, it was an art form for me. And I was just going to have to do get involved with these new people that I was getting acquainted with. And I just sat on the stool, and I never got to the PTA meeting I promised myself that I was going to go to, and I never got to interact in that child's life. The grandparents moved to California, and they took over the next two. And there's 10 years between the oldest son and the next two children. And then, you know, they talk about crossing the invisible line. And I had long since crossed the line. And by that time, we had that house, and we had those outside pleasures of life, and those things that were supposed to make me fit and feel as if I was somebody. And the more I drank, the worse I felt. You know, that void, that emptiness inside, it just seems that one drink was too many, and a million never would have been enough. And I couldn't find out why I always felt so lonely in there and why I was always so afraid. And then it all began to go. And I never believed that I would stand in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and say, thank you, God, that you took away from me everything that I wanted in order to give me what I needed. I needed to get sober and have a second chance at life that I found sitting in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that family who loved me so much. I can still remember that pain as I watched them. And they'd done all those things, and they were part of their church and a part of the community, and and they didn't drink, and they're the kinds that, you know, they have. I have an older sister would put a cube of ice in a glass of wine. And as I watched, listened to Harriet last night, I'd sit across the table and watch the ice melt and wonder, why didn't she drink it? And they kept looking at me, and they started seeing my life totally going down the drain. And I, you know, I had one sister who passed away two weeks before Christmas, this past Christmas. And she cut me off, and she says, I'm not going to enable you anymore. I'm tired of the pain. And I looked at them, and I can remember their eyes. And I would try to say to myself, but they don't understand. They don't understand. And they'd ask me those questions. Why don't you stop drinking? Why don't you stop killing yourself? We love you. And I couldn't, say that because I was in such denial that alcohol had anything to do with it. And finally, the bank foreclosed on the house. The Internal Revenue took the business, sold off the assets, paid off the creditors, took their share. The older son was then 18 years old. The ex-husband had gone because by that time I was in horrendous blackouts. I'm a real alcoholic, the kind that's described on page 21 of the big book. You know, they used to wonder where I was putting the alcohol because I was the one that could take them all home. I could drink any man under the table. I thought this was going to be forever. And there I was, began to pass out spread eagle in the front yard. And the ex-husband looked at me one day and he said, you know what? He said, I can't stand this anymore. You are too violent. And he said, I don't want the responsibility because either you're going to kill me or I'm going to kill you. And he left. And the oldest son stood outside with me, and I had one bag and the two younger kids. That older sister, who is now 86 years old, looked at me and she said, I tell you what, we're not going to hang around and watch you die, but we will pray for you. And I am sure it is the prayers of the people who love me in God's time, and I had to do whatever it was I had to do. And it was their prayers that brought me to my knees and brought me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she kissed me. And they didn't come to see me when I had moved from in front of that house with a bag and two young children to the ghetto of Los Angeles. And I drew the drapes and I applied for food stamps and welfare. And I would look out the window and watch the world go by. That older son would come and see me from time to time, but the look had changed. It was no longer the look of a young child who was looking disappointed at his mother, but now it was an 18-year-old who looked at a mother who was falling on the floor, crawling on the floor, drunk. And it was a look of love and hate. And it was a look of terror and frustration and bewilderment and despair. And the tears would rise, but they wouldn't run, and I guess it just wasn't macho for young men to cry. And finally, he looked at me one day, and he said, you know, we don't really know who you are, because you have never been there for us. And I looked at him, and my attitude about him was the same about as it was about everyone else. And it wasn't, screw you, because you don't know what pain I'm in. If I knew better, I'd do better. And I remember when I did the eighth and ninth step with those kids of mine who are young adults today, you know, I said those very words. If I had known better, I would have done better. And I was doing the best I could. I didn't know that I was a sick person. I thought I was a terrible person and a blight on the universe. Because I'd done those things out there in those streets that fill me up with remorse and shame. And I always dealt with that with another drink to ease that pain. And then my son walked away from me one day in that ghetto, and he said, I won't see you anymore. And I went on and I had another drink. And I started ending up in those hospitals around Los Angeles. There's one, the County General Hospital, particularly on Saturday nights, where nervous interns patching me up. They're very nervous. I can remember them coming at me, and they're shaking, and the needle is shaking, and you know, they're going to patch me up and set me back out there in that world one more time. And it seems to me that I would always, you know, with the black eyes, and even I was in blackouts and hanging in terrible bars. We used to call them bucket of blood bars. And where they fought, and then it was, you know, and I can remember all the violence that went on in those bars, because that's where I had to go by this time. I had no money, and I just had that welfare, and then I'd have to slide up on a stool and talk to a stranger to buy me a drink. And I would end up in those places in those blackouts. Sometimes I'd come out of the blackout just sitting out in the waiting in the waiting area. And then one Sunday morning, one more time, I'd come to a crossroads. And I guess God was one more time trying to get my attention. And I came to an area outside of L.A. It's called Inglewood, California, in Daniel Freeman Hospital. And when I came out of that blackout, I was on that bed, and people who are dedicated to saving your life when you don't want your life saved. You see, because I was too chicken to always commit suicide, because I contemplated I'd sit there. But I never got past that, and what I learned, that committing suicide is a final solution to temporary problems. And I'm glad I had never had the courage, if that's what it takes. And I came to that Sunday morning, one more time on a Sunday morning, and they were working over me. There were two nuns, a young nun about 21 or 22 years old. There was an older nun, probably a lady in her late 60s, and I can remember the gray habits and the growing up in the Baptist church, and that was the first time I'd been in a Catholic hospital, and the police were standing at the foot of the bed. And I came to, and I had a brain concussion. They kicked me in the head, and I was bleeding out of both my eyes, and my ribs had been kicked in, and I was double over in pain, and they were trying to hold me down from the shock, and my body was bouncing around, and I wouldn't cooperate. And my defense against people would be with my inside rage was to badmouth them so they'd get away from me and leave me alone. And this older nun, I remember, she turned and she stormed out of that room when I wouldn't cooperate with the police. And I told the police to buzz off, because they wanted to know who did it and the truth what is, and even today I don't know. And I wasn't going to tell the secret, even if I knew. I'd hung out with the mafia for a number of years, and they said, you better not tell the secret. And I lived around an Indian father who said, we don't tell the secrets. And I came in Alcoholics Anonymous filled with secrets. I heard a man at this podium say one night, you are sick as your secrets. And when I looked up, this young nun was leaning over me. And I can remember her tears began to run down her cheeks. And the tears fell on the covering of that bed. And I know that I have come to believe that God speaks to us through others. And one more time, God was trying to get my attention and spoke to me through that young nun. She looked down at me, and she didn't say the things that people had always said that loved me, like, why don't you stop drinking, and where's your willpower, and if you just do this and if you just do that. This young nun said to me, how did you ever let your life get into such a state? And it was a new question. I didn't know what she meant, but I sensed that something was wrong, and I was going to have to do something about this. And I remember 3 days later, with the brain concussion, they kept me in that hospital 3 days. 3 days later, that same young nun, who was my first messenger, gave me back my wig, my red wig, my bad leather jacket, my jeans and my boots. They take me up with 2.5-inch white adhesive tape right on my ribs to pull them back in place. So I couldn't stand up straight, and I was bent over, and I had this wig on. It was a little bit on sideways, and I couldn't, you know, and I remember this young nun escorted me out to the sidewalk, and she looked at me and she said, try not to drink. And I'm an alcoholic. And I guess, you know, when Dr. Silkworth says, after you take that first drink, the first the phenomenon of craving starts, but I needed a drink because I was shaking and I was detoxing. I didn't know it at the time. I'd been for 3 days without a drink in the hospital. And I looked down the street and I saw a sign that said liquor. And I shuffled off down there and I went in there and I threw this money up there and I bought my ripple and I went back to the ghetto. And one morning it was, I know for me it was my first spiritual experience. Because I came to on the floor one more time in a fetal position, too tired to get off the floor. And I believe what happened to me was a divine intervention. That a power greater than myself must have kissed me gently. And said, child, get off the floor because you don't ever have to live like this again. And I remember I slowly stood up and it's a little bit hazy, but I remember standing up and saying, oh, please, God, help me. And just that moment, I felt something lifted because I had asked for help. And it was not a case of making deals with God, because that's what I always did. I made deals. If you get me off the floor today, I'll do this and I'll do that. I just said, God, help me. I don't want to die. And I picked up the phone. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning when I came out of that blackout. It was about that time I picked up the phone, called a friend who was not an alcoholic, was still my friend. And I said to her, I can't stop drinking, and the secret was finally out. I said, I can't stop drinking. I'm afraid they're going to find me on the floor when Tina and Ken come home today. I said, I just don't want to die like this. She said, I hear there's a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, why don't you call them? Because I hear they stay sober. I don't know how, but I've heard of it. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous until she explained to me that there was such a place. And I picked up the phone at a reasonable hour when the sun came up and the kids had gone off, and I picked up the phone and I said, good morning, my name is Clara. And this man said, good morning, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. May I help you? I said, I can't stop drinking. And he said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, don't drink today. And I don't know how I heard that, because a stranger on the other end of a phone gave me some hope. He said, we don't drink in Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time. You just don't have to drink today. And I heard that. And so the kids had gone off, and around 10 o'clock I began to get dressed for my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope I never have to go through that again. Here I am, 65 pounds overweight. Am I looking good? You know, I was still in the mentality of being in the streets, walking the walk and talking the talk. And I didn't know what you guys were about. So I opened the closet door of what to wear. I had a red velvet dress in there that had wine stains on it. And around 10 o'clock, I began to shake and perspire. I had none of my fair-weather friends that Bill Wilson referred to in his life. He referred to them as fair-weather friends. All of mine are dead. Every person I drank and ran the streets with are dead tonight. And that's why I have got to believe that God had a purpose for me. That I got sober that morning, and I around 10 o'clock, I was dripping wet, and I heard, you know, about detoxing after I got sober. And I didn't know that's what was going on for me, but I had heard that man say, just don't drink today. Around 12 o'clock, I was dripping wet, and I was with my arms folded, just stalking around in that house. And around 2 o'clock, I couldn't stand being in the house anymore, but I didn't make the run. Thank you, God, I didn't make the run. I went over to Woolworths instead and stole some eyelashes. Stole some eyelashes for my first meeting because I wanted to look good. And they come quite long, and I didn't know you were supposed to trim them. So I remember I got my eyelashes. Got back to that house. I called my brother. And it seems to me that God leaves a guardian angel for all of us. There's somebody out there, there's some soul that God makes sure that stands behind you, prays for you, is there to pick up the pieces and love you enough until you can hear the message. And I called this brother and I said, you know, I'm going to a meeting tonight, and the place is called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need a car. And I said, could I borrow your car? And he said, honey, I'll be right over. And he came over, and I can remember he rushed up the stairs, and he opened the door, and he grabbed me, and he kissed me. And he said, I hope this is going to work for you, because it pains us to see you live like this. And he knew that, you know, I'd tried so many things. I'd been to psychiatrists and group therapy. I even went to an East Indian guru once, and I know I read all the East Indian philosophies that I could get my hand on. I can remember sitting in front of the television when Norman Vincent Peale was on television at that time. And he'd, you know, he'd talk about thinking positive. And I'd sit there with that drink and say, that's my problem. You know, I don't think positive. And I'd go in the kitchen, and in that time I was drinking bourbon. And I'd go in the kitchen, make a glass of bourbon, and go sit in front of the television to think positive. And and he said, I hope this is going to work for you. And he kissed me, and he handed me the keys. And he said, keep the car as long as you can use it. You want to use it. And when I got back to the house around 7 o'clock, it was an 8 o'clock meeting. The man had told me it was an 8 o'clock meeting. And when I got back to the house around 7 o'clock, I was all dressed. I had combed up that wig, that girl. You know, I'd been hiding out under that wig for about 5 years. And I know if that wig could have talked, it would have blackmailed me, you know. And I had combed her up and raked it out. I clipped bangs and I'd sprayed it, you know, and I put it on that head foam to keep the wigs on. And hey, she was looking good, you know. But I was just a mess. I was dripping wet. And at 7 o'clock, the eyelashes was the last attraction to go on before I went to my first meeting. And I can remember by that time, I was visibly shaken. And I had these lashes. I put the glue along the edge. And I can remember holding my elbow and waiting for an opportune moment. And then I slammed the lash in. And one end was stuck up here. And one end was down here. And I just couldn't fight getting it on. I leaned in the mirror and I said, you are looking good. And I went off to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember sitting in that chair, and I remember the feeling I felt walking up the walk, because the man in central office that morning had not told me it was in a church. And God works in a mysterious way, because I don't ever remember that he said that. Because I believe if he had said it was in the church, I might not have gone. And it's all, as I understand it now, it's all part of the Master's plans. And I walked up that walk, and there was a young guy standing at the door, and he put his hands out, and his name is Scotty, and we're good friends today, and he said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, get yourself a cup of coffee. And he said, sit down, and the meeting will start soon. And I was bouncing around, and in those days in the meetings, they all had real cups in all the meetings. And I got this coffee, and it was too, I made it too full, and it was going over, and I didn't want you to see me shaking, because it's important to look good and look perfect. I'd always tried to be perfect all my life. And I put the coffee down and sat in the seat. As I sat there in that chair in that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I felt the feeling, and I know today that alcohol had stripped me of all human dignity. And it had stripped me of all moral standards of living. And they certainly weren't standards that I had been taught by my parents growing up, and that I could no longer had when I was drinking, because the drink took all that away from me. And I sat there and I quickly reflected on my life from Atlanta to sitting there, and I guess I felt when I sang in the junior choir in Union Baptist Church in Atlanta, and I hated doing all of that, but I was doing it because I was made to do it and all those rules. But I remembered sitting there in that chair, and I remembered a song that we used to sing in the choir. And a slave had written the song, and it was a song about what the slaves felt they were going to experience when they got to heaven. That God was going to say to him, sit down, child, I know you're tired. And rest a while. And if any of you are new here tonight, I hope you'll just sit down and rest a while. And let us love you until you can love yourself. because those were the words they said to me when I was sitting in my first few meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I sat there I reflected, you know, I had no idea that my life was about to be rocketed into a fourth dimension of living from that meeting. They started that meeting, and they asked for the hands of the newcomer, and I didn't know I was a newcomer. Because I had not learned the language. And I have learned today that the language is the language of the heart. And the lady started to speak. She's the late Gail W. And she started to talk about her feelings. She started to talk about the fear. She started to talk about the loneliness. She started to talk about the feelings of despair, the sense of failure. Couldn't live, couldn't die. And I related to her right away. And that's why it's always so important to me, those of us who are come to this podium, who are the messenger, the messages in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we show up, we suit up and we show up. And we carry the message. And I looked at that woman and I related to her. And when I asked for the hands of the newcomer, the lady behind me touched me on the shoulders, and she was the one who told me I was a newcomer. She said, "Raise your hands, honey, you're a newcomer." And at the coffee break, you know, she gave me her phone number, and she said, you go home and you call me. And I will tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. And she started to say, you know, the preeminent that Alcoholics Anonymous is the, you know, and she started to talk, and she was talking and talking, and I was hearing her, but I wasn't hearing her. And then she said to me, "I'm going to be your sponsor." She said, "You are very sick." And she recognized that. And thank God for the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there I was in the ghetto with no transportation, and I was not employable, and that fine art education I'd had, and none of those things. I had no skills, and I was detoxing, and I detoxed sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, God. With the loving arms of the fellowship, and particularly the women. And when I would start to bounce around in the chairs in the different meetings, they would calm me down and they'd say, "Honey, it's all right. Just don't drink today. And you will be all right." And they, you know, that's what they promised me, and that's all Alcoholics Anonymous promises any of us, is sobriety. You know, they didn't promise me that I was going to get a career again, or that I was going to ever have a loving relationship with my children. They didn't tell me about anything about relationships or that my family would ever speak. They said, "Don't drink today and your life will get better. And you have never lied to me." And I started when I was about 6 months sober. She said to me, "Honey, I think it's time for you to get a job." I wasn't really thrilled with the news. Because I had never really worked. I mean, you know, lifestyle in the streets with the mafia, you don't have to really work for that. And she said, "And I don't get your ego out of the way, and I don't care what you do. We are self-supporting through our own contribution." And I said, "Well, I don't know how to work." She said, "You'll learn. And you get a job." And my first job was as a waitress, and I was a terrible waitress. I was angry, and I was mean, and I hated the customers. I spilled coffee all over them and then bitched them out, you know, and I was not a pretty picture in that coffee shop. But I'm grateful for the people who hired me and they trained me, and it was my first feelings of self-esteem. I began to learn how to show up on time, to give those people a full day's work without being angry and hostile and not a pleasant person to be around. And I still had to take 3 buses to get to that job. And some mornings, I just didn't want to do it. And I would get off the first bus, and I'd call my sponsor and wake her up in the morning. And I'd say to her, "I don't think I can do this today." And she said, "Oh, yes, you can, honey." She said, "Just don't drink." And she'd hang up. And then I'd get on the second bus. And I'd get to that job, and it got better. And I finally, you know, quit that job at the end of my second year, and I went to my home group, and I said to my home group, I said, I think I want to get on. And I learned a lot, you know, because my sponsor had said, you have to learn to be lovable, because you have to learn to love others. And I learned that in those 2 years in that job. So I went back into that business, and I started off, and I always had a problem with rejection. And my home group, the guys in my home group had me print up some business cards. And on my day off from my waitress job, I went into Beverly Hills, into all those rich homes, and I would knock on the doors, and I could never have eye contact with people. Ever since I was 5 years old, I could never look anybody in the face. I always looked down, and that's how I acted. And I would hand them a card, and then I would say, I would like to clean your house, and I do good work, and they'd slam the door, and I'd go back to that meeting, and they said, go back again. Keep going back, and finally a lady hired me, and then finally I got enough customers that I was able to give up the waitress job and hire a young man to come work with me, and that young man still works for me, and when I'm out, you know, traveling around the world and living in the promises, that young man runs my business today. And I'm not only employable. I'm not only employable, I employ 14 people today. And what I do is I practice the principles, and I try to practice the principles in all my affairs, and I have contracts at the homes of the movie stars. And I go into their homes, and I don't steal, and I don't cheat, and I don't pass, and I don't pad the bill. And you see, and I walk with dignity, and I walk with honor as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, of loving God, and the 12 steps of recovery. And I got into those steps, and I did that fourth step, and finally, when I was about 3 years sober, and I made amends to my kids, and when I was about 3 years sober, I started to get well. Because of that business, I started to hear the music, and I started to, I started to skip in meetings, and I started whining and complaining. You see, I've been a whiner and a complainer. I remember at a meeting one time, I took up the whole meeting whining. And I remember this guy, an old timer, came out of the back of the meeting when the meeting was over and put his arms around me in a loving way, and he said, Clara, please, come down off the cross. He said, we need the wood. And I wanted to share this experience and briefly, and it seems that God one more time was getting my attention. Now I had bought a house now, and I had bought this big El Dorado, and I'm back out there, and I hear the music, and that jazz is sounding much better. And when the book says that the insanity will return, and when the insanity returns, we have no mental defense against that first three. And God would put up a sign, and the flag went up, and I was dancing around my living room, and the phone rang, and it was central office. And I had been prancing around AA, and I hadn't really been doing a lot. I was doing a lot of lip service and doing, you know, kind of messing around and showing up, going to a lot of meetings, you know, and I was looking all right on the outside, but nothing was changing on the inside. I wasn't really doing it. And so I was about to step off into that other road again. This lady said, honey, this is central office, and we wondered if you'd make a 12-step call for us. And I wasn't thrilled. I said, where? And she said, it's down on Skid Row. I said, I don't think I'm qualified for that. She got annoyed with me. She said, just take the call. And I got all the information. I called my sponsor. I think I'll call her, and I would help her, you know, get me out of this. I pick up the phone. I call Carol. I said, Carol, I said, no, they want me to do a 12-step call down on Skid Row. And I said, I don't think I can do that. There are other people in Alcoholics Anonymous that have much more experience in 12-step work. And I was just wondering about, she wasn't saying a word. Finally, when she wouldn't respond, I said, look, I don't want to do it. She quietly said, I don't care what you don't want to do. She said, you do it anyway, and she hung up. So I called this young lady that I sponsor, who's a little actress. She was a little actress at the time, and she had about 90 days of sobriety. I had heard you never go on a 12-step call alone. I called her up. I said, we're going on a 12-step call. She said, where?
I said, it's on Skid Row. She said, I don't want to do that. I said, I don't care what you don't want to do. And we went on this 12-step call, and I want to tell you, it was the turning point of my sobriety. And I am totally in 12-step work today. And I'm very happy that there are facilities for people to get sober. But I still look for the alcoholic who is down at that place where they cannot go into those facilities. I look for them. Because it was that 12-step call that changed it all for me. And I remember getting in that car. We found this hotel, and it was not part of the Hilton chain. And we walked into this lobby. They had this big transistor radio, and they had it up on their shoulders, and they were booging in the lobby, and they were drinking wine and beer, and there was no clerk around. There was a red arrow along the wall, and it pointed to a bell, and it said, ring this bell. I rang the bell. This man peeked out, and he said, can I help you? I said, do you have a young lady in here named Dorothy? Oh, he said, yeah, she's up on the third floor. He said, now you take that elevator, and this little baby of mine, we got in this elevator, pulled our pants up because there was urine on the elevator floor. And it zigzagged and got up to the third floor. We stepped over these three alcoholics who had passed out, and the man said, there's no numbers in this hotel, but Dorothy's at the end of the hall. And we walked on in, and we knocked on that door. And a little voice said, come in. And we opened the door, and I stepped into another world, and I saw the roots of the disease, and I saw the yet. And on the floor, curled up in a fetal position, was a young woman about 21 years old, blonde and pretty, drowning in her own vomit. Water bugs were so thick, they crunched while we walked on the floor. They were all over her, and wine bottles were everywhere, and I will never forget the stench of that room. And I looked at her, and it was a spiritual awakening, as the 12th step says that we will have. And I said, but by the grace of God, this could be me. And I heard the message. And I had another feeling about this program. And I heard the things I'd heard in the meetings. I went downstairs, called central office. They told us where to take it. We were further into the Skid Row area. And we got her registered in this little place. And then we took her to an all-night diner. And this baby and I were feeding her coffee and trying to get her sober. And we had dressed her and cleaned her up. And for the first time in my whole life, I had some feeling of compassion for another human being. And a user and abuser of people is what I'd always been all my life. I took, never gave anything. And my selfishness kept me always doing that. And for the first time, I felt some feeling of compassion for that young woman. And we dressed her, and we were sitting across from her in this diner, and she was quite drunk. And I began to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, the first step says we are powerless over alcohol, and the second half of the first step said, and our lives are unmanageable. She could relate to that. The second step said, I talked about God will restore us to sanity. She talked about the insanity in her family. They'd all died of alcoholism or drug addiction. We got to step three, and I said, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God. And she stood up, and she said, don't you talk to me about God. And I think I had some unresolved anger. Because I'm busy carrying a message now. I reached across the table, grabbed her by that little pink sweater, pulled her flowers, and punch her out. But the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening, as a result of the step, we carry the message. And that was the beginning of service. And that's what my life is today, service, giving back the gift. That 8-year-old daughter that I couldn't fix breakfast for, 14 weeks ago, tomorrow, I was in the hospital where she and her wonderful little husband were having their first child. And I had the privilege, by God's grace, to be there. To wipe the perspiration from her brow, to rub her feet and hold her hand, while she went through the pain of labor. And to see her look down at me and say, Mother, I love you. And I am so glad you are here with me today to have this experience. And those are what the promises promise us. A new freedom, a new happiness. And that son who said, I don't know who you are, is going through a divorce. And I am there for him today. And his little son holds my hand, and on Wednesday we went to buy the new turtle, I mean a new Pete's thing. And he holds one finger as we walk, and he talks fast, and he calls me Grandma Clara. And he's never seen me wake up with a stranger. And he's never seen me crawl on the floor. That family who loved me so much. We are a family of love, and that sister who cut me off, who passed away 2 weeks before Christmas, we stood in that hospital and we held hands and she prayed. And thank God that she had for 81 years experience of being in this family. And she said, I hate to leave you, but I gotta go. And I'm thank God I had made the eighth and ninth step with her. And I felt that absolutely free. And if you haven't done that fourth step and those steps and made those amends, life is brief and very fragile. And this is not a rehearsal. We gotta do it now. And I owe it all to rooms like this, that you rendered me sober and you rendered me sane through the grace of God. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. Thank you.